Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, one and all, and welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we taste as good as we smell. Oh, yes, we do. Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by the brand new forum on Web Sleuths. It's the Web Sleuth Weather Forum. Say that 20 times with your mouth full. If you like to talk about the weather, follow the weather, dream about the weather, dress up like a cloud on Friday nights when you're alone, well then, the new Web Sleuth Weather Forum is for you. Go to www.websleuths.com/forums, and at the top of the page, you'll see a link to our brand new weather forum. It's time for all this legal goo. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and I take no responsibility for them. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuths.com LLC and formsforjustice.org. In other words, if you hear something tonight that you don't like and you're just so upset, don't take it out on websleuths or formsforjustice.org. You have to come to me, Trisha's True Crime Radio. It's all here, and we stand alone as we face the world tonight. And coming up in just a little bit, we have a very fascinating show for you. Cheryl McCollum and Dr. Sherry Jefferson of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute are joining us tonight along with their students. And we're going to hear both sides of the opening arguments from these students in the George Zimmerman trial. Now, nothing like this has ever been done to the best of my knowledge on radio, so this is a first for us all, and I know you're going to enjoy it. But first up, I need you to imagine this. Imagine your sister goes out with her fiancé to a movie. He returns home from the movie and says, yeah, we got into a fight, and she got out of the car and started walking. But then you never saw your sister again. Imagine if that happened in 1975. Your imagination just took you into a family's real-life nightmare. Joe Lewalski's sister, Sylvia, just vanished, and it gets even worse. Not only did Sylvia just vanish, but nobody seems to be doing anything about it. And it's been 40 years other than Sylvia's family. The police won't do anything. The media won't do anything. But Trisha's True Crime Radio and our wonderful listeners, hopefully we can get something accomplished tonight that hasn't been able to be accomplished in 40 years. Let's welcome Sylvia's brother, Joe, to our show tonight. Joe, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, Trish, I can't thank you enough for having me on. Thanks.
Well, I'm hoping that we will be able to help you with your sister's case. It has been close to 40 years, and I know this must be very frustrating for you, and not to mention heartbreaking. Let's talk about that night in 1975. Tell us what you know, what happened that night with your sister, Sylvia.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, the best of my recollection, my sister went out with her fiancé that night. They were to see a 5:30 movie that was about 20 minutes away, and the movie was only going to be perhaps 2 hours. And so instead of coming back at around 7:30, 8 o'clock, her fiancé came back. It was closer to 10:30, and told my parents that during the heat of an argument, my sister had thrown her glasses against the dashboard and fled from the car. And that was the last time we heard anything about her. Following day, my mother went down to the police department, a 1-2 precinct, and she filed a missing persons report. And a detective that took the case did some investigation and then actually wrote on the missing persons report, will not investigate. And the case, for the most part, has sat idle since then.
Since 1975. Why did the police officer detective write that? Just because back then, I think we thought of missing people, especially adults, is like, oh, they'll come back, or if they want to come back, they will. Was it just that dismissive at the time in 1975? It was just they were done with it?
Well, part of the reasoning, from what I understand, was that she was over 21, and the excuse that we got is she was listed as running away, was the excuse the police department basically gave us. So they I don't know if they just did not want to investigate it, or perhaps there was something else involved. But the bottom line is the police report still has on it, will not investigate.
We won't get into the particulars here, but there, who knows what really happened. When you say maybe there's something else involved, it could get, there could be all kinds of things going on here, and that is what is so frustrating for you, Joe, is knowing that your sister is out there somewhere and somebody knows what happened and nobody's doing anything about it. We're talking with Joe Lewalski. His sister Sylvia has been missing since 1975. The police detective wrote, will not investigate, and nobody has done anything since. Let's fast forward to today, Joe. You talk to the police. What do they say?
Well, basically, since it's been a cold case for such a length of time without new evidence, they pretty much refuse to open it. They don't want to waste, from what I understand, waste the resources to look into this. I had the state troopers in New York. I've got an officer named Kim Law up here. I reached out to New York City cold case detectives. Wendell Stratford, the 1-2 precinct captain currently, is Captain Kelly, one of the captains there. I spoke with her. And Richmond County DA, Patrick Savage. And for the most part, without new evidence, they really can't open a case or proceed anywhere with it, from what I understand.
And the catch-22 is, you're not going to find new evidence unless you investigate. And that is the frustrating, one of the many frustrating things about this case. Have you been in touch with her fiancé lately? Did he just drop out of the picture?
Well, actually, I was told by several law enforcement officials not to engage in conversation with her ex-fiancé. For fear of being sued for harassment. So I was asked to stay clear and not pose any questions about the case.
Okay, that, to me, that right there, I have so many red flags going up about that. A police department telling you not to talk to someone you know who was the last one to see your sister alive. That just doesn't make any sense unless other things happen to be in play here. Tell us about your sister, Sylvia. Give us an idea of what she's like.
Oh, she was a grade A student, went through Tonville High School, grade A Dean's List student through Wagner College, and she was in two sororities through Wagner, and a biology major, straight A student, straight-laced. She didn't even have a cavity as far as I knew. I was trying to get her dental records for DNA evidence. And from what I turned up, she didn't even have a cavity at age 21 to paint the picture, so to speak, of type of person she was. I have memories of her actually reading to the blind. We used to go down to the beach. And on weekends, she would take on side projects through the sororities. So she was just a sweet girl. I just, it's been so many years, I don't remember too much. But, you know, these things I do remember.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you do have those memories to hold on to. So you assume, and I think most people would assume, that she is dead, correct?
Yeah, for the most part. I also, just last week or the week before, visited her best friend in Pennsylvania. I went to visit her best friend going through college, in fact. She was supposed to be interviewed by the police department regarding my sister being missing. And the police didn't follow up as far as even seeing her best friend at the time. So the picture I'm painting from the PD at the time was they didn't invest any resources into even looking into this. They just said it was a runaway and that was it, and they closed the books.
I mean, you would think common sense tells you that a police department should interview at least the best friend of the person. Maybe she was in fear of someone. Maybe there is this big nugget of information that she could have given the police that could have taken them on the right track to finding your sister. And so to this day, they won't even interview her because they need new information. But like I said, they're not going to get new information unless they start interviewing. Joe, where did this take place? In what city in New York?
This was on Staten Island, New York, Richmond County, New York.
The movie theater
was actually off of Richmond Avenue, and from what I understand, the incident took place adjacent to the movie theater was a Kmart shopping center, and from what I understand, it was at a an intersection in the Kmart shopping plaza.
Okay, and hold on one second. I'm just getting a little bit of interference here. I want to bring in Cheryl McCollum. Cheryl is one of the people involved with the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. And Cheryl, hi, Cheryl, are you with us?
Hey, I am.
Hey, Cheryl, what would you give, what advice would you give Mr. Joe Lookout? Look, excuse me, I'm choking
well,
here, I apologize. What advice would you give him? I apologize. Go ahead.
No problem. Joe, first of all, I'm so sorry, but the thing that came to my mind almost immediately, have you been associated with NamUs or any organization that would take your DNA to cross-check people that have been recovered for mitochondrial DNA?
Yes, ma'am, I have. Actually, Detective Patrick Savage from the Richmond County DA's office. I submitted DA samples to him, and we are
but
up
I'm saying,
on it.
For
I'm
a national database? For a national database?
I'm unaware of what Detective Patrick Savage did with the DNA. From what I understand, it is listed in a in a DNA bank, and I don't know how far that DNA bank goes.
Okay. And the second thing is there any proof that they actually made it to the movie?
No, ma'am.
That's just his story. Okay.
Yes.
So basically, here's the deal. If they left the house at 4:30 and he returned alone at 10:30, there's basically 6 hours there. She can't be more than 3 hours away then if he had something to do with it. Right?
Yes, ma'am. That's understood. It was 5:30, I believe, that they left.
Okay. Well, I thought that was the movie. I didn't know if they left early to get something to eat. But I'm just saying, okay, then it's even smaller. So where you're searching is going to be really a tighter circle. The other thing that I find interesting is somebody's going to worry about harassment when it's been this many years. That's a word that is, you know, it's not like you call him every week. was he involved with any searches or did he help look for her? Did he put up posters?
In the reverse, actually, the phone calls after the incident, he was rather nasty. This is just from my sister's best friend. She called the fiancé a few days after and a week after and 2 weeks after, and he was rather belligerent about receiving these phone calls and being asked to leave him alone. Yeah, he was not supportive at all in as you know, to try to find my sister, even
Joe,
though they were engaged to be married.
Is he still alive then?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Okay. And have you haven't attempted to contact him at all lately, correct?
I haven't, period. I mean, I was told not to for the fear of a lawsuit.
That's so bizarre. Cheryl, the media is also just not paying any attention to this. I'm more than willing to put out a press release to help Mr. Lebowski with his sister's disappearance. Is there something that you could suggest that we could do as well, maybe to get some media interest in this?
Well, I mean, certainly web suits is a great way to start. And
right.
I think it's just the ultimate mystery. I mean, you're talking about somebody that was in love. She was a good person. She was a good student. And supposedly there was an argument and she got out of the car, which, I mean, that's not uncommon. You hear about it, but the twist here is he disappears, and he shows back up at her parents alone. Well, I mean, that's intriguing, and I would think that there would be some interest in the media just based on that, and since there's never been a conclusion. I mean, obviously, nobody's ever been named suspect. They didn't investigate it.
Exactly.
God, this is just, it's just one of those you just hate to hear, because there's all kind of red flags that at least somebody
mm-hmm.
should have run them down. But I'll tell you what, Joe, I'll talk to Tricia off air and see if there's some things that maybe we can put together and try to help you too, okay?
I deeply appreciate it. Thank you.
Perfect.
Joe Lewowski, thank you so much, and we will help you any way we can to find your sister, Sylvia. She's very lucky to have a loving brother like you helping her. And at the very least, I bet we can get some media interest that maybe will put a little pressure on the police. They never like to have that spotlight on them, and sometimes when it's turned on them, they can amazingly get up and do things. So we'll definitely do everything we can to help you. Thank you so much for joining us, Joe.
And Trish,
yes.
I can't thank you enough. Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And if, again, you have my phone number, you call me anytime, but we will be in touch, okay?
Very good. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, wow. That is just sad. Very, very sad. Isn't it, Cheryl?
Oh, it's awful.
Yeah, I mean, this poor man for 40 years, why was he told not to talk to the guy? And the guy's belligerent when the woman is missing and he just takes off. There's something, here's the thing, I know there's some big chunk here that we're not getting, that we're not being told. I'm not saying that Joe is not telling us. I'm saying the police and the fiance, there's something funky
right.
going on there. And hopefully the media will take some interest in it, and we will be able to help this man bring his sister home after almost 40 years. Okay. We are ready. It is going to be an amazing show tonight. We have Cheryl McCollum, and we're going to welcome right now Dr. Sherry Jefferson. And Dr. Jefferson is with the Investigative Cold Case Research Institute. Dr. Jefferson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, and happy Father's Day to those in your listening audience. If I may take a few moments while the gentleman may still be listening to the show to
sure.
just give him two bits of information. As he was conversing, two things came to mind for me. One is for him to take advantage of social media. If he has any photos of his sister, he might want to start a face page website or Instagram. See who signs on. If this individual doesn't believe that his sister is deceased, he or anyone in that area would be amazed to see that she would have a website. So you'll be surprised as to who might try to utilize that Facebook page and friend her and an effort to make contact with her. So
mm-hmm.
that might be a start to take advantage of social media. The other thing that he might choose to do, being a native New Yorker, you have the New York Daily News and the New York Post. He can always run an ad that says missing person, anyone with information. So he's not precluded from engaging in investigative services on his own. Finally, the other thing that he may be able to do is to converse with the police department and try and find out if he could secure any telephone records, because if this individual in-law or the fiancé doesn't know or didn't know that she is deceased, then he would have been attempting to call her on numerous occasions following the altercation after the movie. But if you know that this person is deceased, you would make no attempts to reach out to her thereafter. So I didn't
mm-hmm.
hear him say anything about whether or not this gentleman tried to call her after that, make contact, come by the house, visit, or if he just settled with the fact that she had allegedly vanished.
I think he just settled with the fact that she had allegedly vanished. And that, Dr. Jefferson, is the rub here. That's the problem. He just took off. The police said don't contact him, and the police washed their hands of it. And you're right about the social media. That's one thing I'll be talking with him about. They do have a discussion going on Web Sleuths, but there is a lot we can do to help Joe find his sister Sylvia. So thank you very much. Cheryl, do we have you back, my dear?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Okay, Cheryl McCollum and Dr. Sherry Jefferson, let's talk about the George Zimmerman case. Let's talk with Dr. Jefferson first. This is a case that you have been studying with your students. Dr. Jefferson, tell us how you picked the prosecution and the defense teams that we're going to hear tonight, because I think this is a great way to do it. Tell us how you went about it.
How we went about it was we posted signs seeking individuals who were interested in serving as prosecutors and defense in the George Zimmerman case. And all those who signed up to serve as prosecutors and defense attorneys, we alternated. So if you selected the prosecutor as the role that you wanted to play, we made you a defense attorney. Because that says to us that if you succeed in wanting to be a prosecutor, then you've pretty much already made your mind up as to his culpability or guilt. So by switching the roles, it enables these individuals to learn objectivity, which are required for those in the criminal justice field.
That is absolutely brilliant. And we have many of your students on the phone with us tonight. A few have called in late, so I apologize. I do not have a producer tonight, so I have to be producer and host. And I'm just going to go to the phones and get the people that have called in late, get them ready to go. And this is area code 470-865. Who am I speaking with?
Hello.
Hi, who's this?
Oh, this is Camille. I had to call back in. I'm sorry.
Oh, you had to. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Can you spell Camille? Can you spell your first name again? Okay.
K-A-M-Y-L-L-A.
Okay. And your last name, please.
Y-A-N-C-E-Y.
Okay, great. Okay, hang on. I'm going to put you right back on hold, okay?
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, there we have one. Now we have one other student, I believe, that has called in. And then we'll be ready to go. Okay, this is area code 678-353. Who am I speaking with?
Shanika Cardi.
Can you spell your first name, please?
S-H-E-R-N-I-K-A. Last name, U-P-I-S.
Can you spell? You broke up. I apologize. What is it?
S-H-E-R-N-I-K-A.
Uh-huh.
Left Curtis, C-U-R-T-I-S.
Got it. Got it. Shanika Curtis. Fantastic. Okay. Cheryl and Dr. Jefferson, I think we have everybody here. So how would this work normally if this were the case, would the prosecution go first?
Well, ideally what we want to do, if you allow us the opportunity, is to get some history about the program, explain mm-hmm. why we chose this particular case and how it's applicable to the Cold Case Institute, because one might question in the audience, why are they using George Zimmerman when he's alive and he's the suspect in the case? So it wouldn't ideally fit into a cold case, if you will. And then we wanted to be able to break down some of the important issues that both the prosecutor and the defense will experience, then do a sample opening, both prosecutor and defense. At that time, if you want to open for Q&A, you're more than welcome to do so. Then discuss some of the roles of the different witnesses and the evidence that the prosecutor and the defense must take into consideration. Then we'll mm-hmm. go forward with closing, again, prosecutor and then the defense, and then any final notes that you would have for us.
Fantastic. Okay, Dr. Sherry Jefferson, I have you on the air, and I have Cheryl McCollum on the air. Is there anybody else you need on the air right now?
Momentarily, no.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Dr. Sherry Jefferson of the Investigative Cold Case Research Institute, the floor is yours. We're going to talk about the Zimmerman case, but let's hear about the Institute first.
Thank you. One of the reasons why we chose the George Zimmerman case was to afford the students in the program the opportunity to not only learn investigative skills, but more importantly, to be able to apply the investigative skills that they learned academically. That includes, but is not limited to, forensic science, crime scene investigation, criminal justice and procedure, police administration, introduction to law, and constitutional law. By enabling them to utilize the academic studies and curriculums that they're taking in college, they're able to apply that to these particular cases. One of the reasons why we chose George Zimmerman particularly was not only is it a current case and a relevant case, but because there are very convoluted issues pertaining to the case that apply to the academic curriculum that the students have. The ultimate goal here upon completing this particular mock trial is to be able to allow these students to utilize the experiences that they gathered so that they can apply it to the cold cases that are currently pending. That is to be able to utilize these experiences and training so that they will be able to properly investigate cold cases, in turn, engage in mock jury trials based on the findings in those mock jury trials, allow the prosecutors to review this information with hopes that they will convene a grand jury with hopes that they would seek an indictment.
Fantastic. All right. Bravo. That is amazing. Okay, so Dr. Jefferson, where do we go from here as we continue on with our case? It's the George Zimmerman trial. We're taking it on with the Investigative Cold Case Research Institute. Dr. Jefferson, what is next?
What's next is for us to really understand some of the implications that both a guilty or a not guilty verdict will have. While there are many people who are more concerned with the race issues, if you will, which have plagued this case, unfortunately, there are many, with all due respect, that have lost sight of the constitutional implications that this case would have. When one thinks about the O.J. Simpson case, originally that, too, was plagued by more race division, that people lost focus on the ultimate underlying issue, which was that of domestic violence. What we're attempting to do through this particular mock jury trial in the George Zimmerman case is to highlight the constitutionality of the issues, such as one's Second Amendment right to bear arms, whether an individual has a fundamental right to protect him or herself by use of deadly force, and or whether or not an individual is engaged in vigilantism. So a guilty verdict in this case would allow us to understand the impact or the constitutional implications of us not being able to exercise our fundamental rights to protect ourselves in our home and or our person. I call it, with the utmost respect, the onion effect. And the onion effect is, if you look at the history of our right to protect ourselves over the last 20 years throughout this country, they have sort of been peeled back in layers. There was a time where if you were the victim of a carjacking, you could use deadly force. Now, in most jurisdictions in our State of the Union, if you use deadly force in a carjacking, you can be charged with homicide. So the argument is that you cannot use deadly force to protect your property. So this particular case could very well repeal, abolish, or cause to be amended legislative protections that are currently in place. So we need to be mindful and watchful of what a guilty verdict could do. Notwithstanding, we equally need to be concerned about the effects of a not guilty verdict. Will that set the stage for individuals to engage in vigilantism? And if so, then we are really setting ourselves up for some critical problems. So again, through the mock trial, we're really hoping that we can get people to hone in to some of the implications that either decision or ruling, if you will, may have, so that we could take the focus off whether this is a black or white person who's victim and or suspect, and focus on what this decision will do to us as a country and as individuals whose citizens' rights could be adversely affected.
That is the big question. You're absolutely right. And it's hard to get past the race issue. On Web Sleuths, it got so ugly that we had to close down the forum for a while. We're going to reopen the discussion as soon as the trial starts. But honestly, Dr. Jefferson, it was so ugly and so mean that it made me sick. And you're right. We need to look past the race issue for other implications that this case will have for not only people in Florida, but for everywhere else. We're talking with Dr. Sherry Jefferson from the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. Tonight we're going to hear from the students. They have been chosen to give the prosecution side and the defense side in the George Zimmerman trial, and how they were chosen. They signed up for what side they wanted to work on, and then Dr. Jefferson switched them. So if they wanted to be on the prosecution, they got to the defense, and vice versa. Okay, Dr. Jefferson, what's next on our agenda?
What's next is to very briefly discuss some of the important issues that both the prosecutor and the defense will have to overcome. And thereafter, we'll then allow for the prosecution team, which is headed by Ms. Kimberly Matthews, and the defense team, which is headed by Ms. Kristen Stevens, to go forward with their opening. And then
Fantastic.
I'll do a formal introduction, if you will, of the students that are participating. I do ask that Ms. Matthews and Ms. Stevens recognize each team participant, whether they're going to be given an opening or participate in the closing. With that being said, very quickly some of the important issues that the prosecutor is going to have to consider in this case is the ability to overcome vigilantism and or self-defense. It is very difficult to expect an individual when he or she is engaged in a physical altercation to have to second guess whether they are in fact subject to and or facing death. And so the prosecutor is going to have to overcome that burden. Equally so, the prosecutor is going to have to overcome justifying the 45-day delay that it took before her agency, if you will, indicted him and or commenced with an indictment, and the police department made a decision to make an arrest. Some of the issues that the defense is going to have to take into consideration is, A, whether to call George Zimmerman to the witness stand and have him to testify, being aware he has a right to exercise his Fifth Amendment, which is that he does not have to implicate himself, and if he chooses to exercise that right, will his absence or failure to do so cause him to be adjudged guilty? Some of the other things the defense has to take into consideration is the history of Mr. Zimmerman, respectfully, is documented by records, both public and private, which have alleged that he has called 911 on numerous occasions. So one of the concerns that one may have if they're listening and following this case is an individual who has allegedly called 911 almost 100 times over the course of his services, both as a private citizen and in his employment capacity as a volunteer, as a Neighborhood Watch Association member, why he did not call 911 when he had discharged his firearm and shot Mr. Trayvon Martin. The other issue is why he's contending he only fired one bullet. If it is true that he had applied for and originally sought to be a police officer and engaged in training, then he is well abreast that it would only take one bullet when you fire into the torso of an individual that will resolve in that person's death. So there are several little obstacles, if you will, that I'm sure both the prosecutor and the defense are going to have to take into consideration. Some of the other things that the defense has to take into consideration for the prosecutor is whether or not a forensic psychological evaluation should have been performed on Mr. Zimmerman as requested by the prosecutor. And to date, there is no documentation before the court that is part of their discovery that they sought and or obtained a forensic psychological evaluation, which in regard to the state of mind, both before, during, or after, or since that particular night in February. So with that being said, and just putting out some general information for the viewing audience to take into consideration, I'll introduce to some and present to others Ms. Kimberly Matthews and Ms. Shanika Curtis, and they will present their opening.
Okay, we have Kimberly Matthews and Shanika Curtis on the line. And is Kimberly going to go first?
I can introduce everybody that's on my prosecutor's team, and then Shanika will go ahead with her opening.
Okay, this is Kimberly Matthews. And first of all, before you get started, Kimberly, I just want to thank all of the students from the Investigative Cold Case Research Institute. You're going to do a great job. Take your time, just speak slowly, and we're here to learn from you tonight. So, Kimberly Matthews, the floor is yours, my dear.
Hello, everyone. Good evening. My name is Kimberly Matthews, and I am the lead prosecutor in the Zimmerman mock trial. And also, we have Shanika Curtis. She is an investigator and the second attorney, and she will do the open argument. Then we have Ms. Tiffany Funches, which she is an investigator and first attorney, and James Bowen. He is an investigator. And last but not least, Deanna Robinson, which she is our paralegal, and she will be doing the closing argument. So Shanika can go ahead and do her opening for the prosecutors.
Shanika Curtis, the opening arguments for the prosecution in the George Zimmerman trial. Go right ahead.
Yes. Good evening, everyone. This is Shanika Curtis, and we're here today to talk about the death of Trayvon Martin, who was sentenced to death and gunned down by Mr. George Zimmerman. All Trayvon had was a thirst for a cold iced tea that led him to death. He didn't have the chance to stand in front of the justice system like the rest of us to prove his innocence. That was taken away from him by Mr. Zimmerman, who made the decision to charge him with everything he possibly could by sentencing him to death with a single gunshot wound to the torso. As we carry on, the state will prove to you and the evidence will show how a young American citizen male who chose to put on a hoodie and stand in the rain was convicted, his rights was taken away, and how he was sentenced to death this cold February night. Mr. Zinnerman had already identified Trayvon as a suspect. Why? Because his age, because he had on a hoodie, and he was in an unfamiliar area where he was not recognized. Now, the thing is, with all the American citizens, this is one person or any young American person should be able to walk anywhere. He was there to just go get a pack of Skittles for his 7-year-old brother. He was gunned down. Mr. Zinnerman have no remorse. After Trayvon was murdered, you know, he was just left there in a cold rain. It was wet. Mr. Zinnerman fought that and stated that he had to murder Trayvon because he had to stand his own law. So what we hear today and what we're talking about today is how his rights were taken away, and that's very not understandable. So me and my prosecution team, we got together and we basically just trying to decide. We're trying to figure out. It's not only our only opinion. We just here trying to figure out, is this right that every young male who wears a black hoodie is supposed to be murdered by someone? So that's all for me. That's all I have to say for my opening.
Thank you. That's Shanika Curtis from the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute giving the opening arguments for the prosecution in our mock trial of George Zimmerman tonight. And we have Dr. Sherry Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson, what is next up on our agenda?
I am going to give a sample opening, and then I'm going to allow the defense to do theirs. And let me allow your audience to understand this. What we did is, my background is also that as a doctorate of jurisprudence and that I'm a practicing attorney as well. So we were able to teach them all of the rules of evidence that they needed to know, how to proceed with discovery, courtroom decorum, opening, closing, presentment of evidence, witness questioning, direct and cross and redirect. So these students have worked very hard and diligent, if you will, toward trying to understand the fundamentals of trial advocacy. Allow me to just give you, off the top of my head, ladies and gentlemen, a quick opening so that you also have a general understanding of some of the information that we're working with. We're not using general information that we've come up with on our own. Rather, the information that we are using is strictly that which is available under the Freedom of Information Act and or information that is generally available to the public. We are using only evidence. We're not going on our personal views. We're not dealing with emotionalism. We are dealing with fact, evidence, best practices. With that being said, I'm going to just quickly give your audience an opening if I were proceeding as the prosecutor. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. I'm attorney Sherry Jefferson, and I represent the state in the matter of the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we will hear the events that transpired on February 26, 2012. On that evening, the suspect, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, was pointed out by George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman contacted 911 in an effort to assert that he had observed suspicious activity. In the course of the four-minute telephone conversation that he had with 911 operator, the evidence will show that based on his communications with 911, that Trayvon Martin did not engage in any activity that would have caused him to be subject to and or the victim of justifiable homicide. Throughout the course of the four-minute telephone conversation with the 911 operator, George Zimmerman could never attest to and or state that Mr. Trayvon Martin had engaged in any activity that would have otherwise justified homicide. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you are called upon today to be able to examine whether the acts committed by Trayvon Martin before the 911 call and or during the 911 call speaks to what transpired in the 30 seconds to 90 seconds thereafter. What we do know about the 911 call is that Mr. Zimmerman was clearly directed to cease and desist from following Mr. Martin. Notwithstanding, we do note from the evidence that he exited his vehicle and pursued Mr. Martin in hot pursuit. Thereafter, we are aware that there is allegations that a fight ensued between Mr. Zimmerman and Mr. Martin. Are we to believe, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that there would be evidence that would support that Mr. Trayvon Martin struck Mr. Zimmerman first after he himself took off on foot in an effort to get away? Or are we going to hear evidence and or have reason to believe that Mr. Zimmerman, using his 9mm Glock, told Mr. Trayvon Martin to halt, thereby causing Mr. Martin to raise up his arms in a defenseless manner to be struck one time with a bullet? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it is undisputed that Mr. George Zimmerman served the community in Twin Lake as a neighborhood watch member. It is undisputed, and the evidence will show, that he called 911 at least 100 times in the course of 36 months in his capacity as both citizen and a member of the watch. However, the evidence will show that immediately upon firing upon Trayvon Martin, that he did not contact 911. He did not seek medical services from 911, nor did he seek police intervention. Now, they may argue, the defense that is, that the reason why he did not call 911 is because an individual arrived on the scene who, ladies and gentlemen, have noted as witness number 13, and that upon arrival of that particular witness, that this individual, realizing that he was not a police officer, still neither person contacted 911. Neither person sought EMS services. Mr. Zimmerman alleged that he was being beaten and struck on numerous occasions by Mr. Martin. But the evidence is going to show that according to the medical examiner's report, that there was no blood plasma on Mr. Zimmerman that was conclusive to match that of Trayvon Martin. In other words, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if it is true that Mr. Martin covered Mr. Zimmerman's mouth with his hand, then there would have been blood plasma on Mr. Martin's hand. But upon careful review and examination of the medical coroner's report, you will learn on this day that there was no blood plasma or DNA on Mr. Trayvon Martin's hand. Therefore, the evidence will show that Trayvon Martin was struck and killed with one gunshot to his torso in event to, quote-unquote, make sure that these assholes, as quoted directly on the 911 recording, would not get away. It was a decision made by Mr. Zimmerman, as noted in his police report, that the suspect, 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, would not be afforded the opportunity to have his day in court. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a decision made by Mr. George Zimmerman that he would serve as the police, the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court of Florida, the U.S. Supreme Court, pardons and parole, the Sentencing Review Board, and he would sentence Trayvon Martin to death. And that decision, ladies and gentlemen, can never be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sherry Jefferson from the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. We are holding our mock trial for George Zimmerman with Dr. Jefferson and the students of the Institute. And we heard earlier from one of the students. And now, Dr. Jefferson, what is next up?
We are now going to hear from the defense, and this will be led by Kristen Stevens and her team.
Okay, let's go to Christian Stevens. Christian, you are on the air. Welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio, and you are on the defense side for George Zimmerman. So, my dear, the floor is all yours.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Christian Stevens, and I am the lead defense attorney. Allow me to introduce my team, Ms. Camilla Yancey, who is our lead investigator, Ms. Ebony Harris, who is our lead second attorney, and Mr. John Battle, who could not be with us at this moment, who is my third chair. I will be doing the opening statement for the defense. Good morning, Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. My name is Christian Stevens, and I represent Mr. George Zimmerman. Today, a man's life and character is on trial because he did what he felt was right to protect his own life. Mr. Zimmerman was on the Neighborhood Watch Association for 3 years, and during this period, George called the police, and he never was involved in an altercation. I want to presume the role of George Zimmerman. Greetings. I am George Zimmerman, everyone, and this is my story. On that rainy, damp night of February 26, 2012, I was on my way to the store just like any other day. Before I came across Mr. Martin, an unfamiliar face in our neighborhood who had created a suspicion immediately by standing in the rain in the front of a resident's home. After observing him for a period of time from my vehicle, I proceeded to call 911. At this point, Mr. Martin walked past my vehicle. I observed Mr. Martin reaching for something that I perceived to be a weapon because immediately thereafter he took on foot and ran when he noticed my vehicle. But I did not discharge my weapon at this point. Being a licensed weapon holder, I had every right to carry around my firearm with me at all times. At some point during our 911 call, I saw Mr. Martin take off on foot, which confirmed my suspicions of him. Then I returned to my vehicle to wait for the police, but I was ambushed by Mr. Martin. He appeared out of nowhere and punched me in the nose with what felt like a blunt object in his hand. I fell to the ground, and Mr. Martin got on top of me and began banging my head on the concrete walkway. I screamed for help, but no one came to my rescue. So then, believing that I was going to die from blunt force to my head, that is when I pulled my weapon and shot one, and only one shot. At that time, Witness 13 appeared to help me to restrain him until Officer Timothy Smith arrived on scene. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what evidence will show. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Christian Stevens from the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. As we continue on with our mock trial in the George Zimmerman case, and Dr. Sherry Jefferson, what is up next? We've heard from the prosecution and the defense, and what is in store for us now?
What's in store for us now is just to very briefly go over some of the witnesses and the evidence that will be presented in both the mock trial that is available and the actual trial in Florida. And I think that this is important for purposes of us having a clear understanding of what we use. There are the 911 operator calls, which is the original call that was placed by Mr. George Zimmerman himself. That is the four-minute telephone call. There was also a 911 call that is placed by a citizen of that community in which that call actually allows for us to hear the screams and calls for help as well as the gunshot. We also used the police report that George Zimmerman completed, in which about seven times in that report, if not more, he refers to Trayvon Martin as a quote-unquote suspect without substantiating or giving any reason for why he's using that particular term. There are a lot of police lingo, if you will, that is used throughout the police report that he completed on that evening. Some of the other evidence that we use includes but is not limited to the actual medical examiner or coroner's report, and we also have utilized the photographs that were available. They include but are not limited to the crime scene photographs that were taken, which also shows Mr. Trayvon Martin's body erect, if you will, on the ground with a yellow bag covering it to protect it from the rain. They also show where the gunfire, the bullets were actually landed, or the bullet, if you will. It also shows the tree and the cement area in the walkway where it is alleged that Mr. Zimmerman had sustained his injuries. We also have photos of Mr. Zimmerman's injuries, which include but are not limited to those that were taken by him as well as by members of EMS and or the police while he's inside of the police vehicle. There is clearly a showing of this gentleman suffering or having sustained either some type of blunt force to his nasal, his nose passage area, as well as to the back of his head. We also included but not limited to the information that was made available for Trayvon Martin's girlfriend. And I want to stop and focus on her for a moment because I think both prosecutor and defense really have an interesting opportunity in examining her as a witness. the prosecutor would need to be very careful in its examination of her as a witness, primarily because in the actual case, Judge Nelson has precluded them, as in most criminal cases, from entering into character witness. But because of the girlfriend, a defense attorney, if properly laying the foundation, he or she may very well be able to get that young lady to say things that might be indicative of them allowing the jury to make a connection, if you will, between Trayvon's character and hers. We always heard birds of the feather flock together, or association draws assimilation. So if this young woman were to come into the court as the prosecutor's witness based on her communications with Mr. Martin, and she's wearing a suit, if you will, and her fancy shoes, and she's speaking very proper, and she's able to come across to the jury well, then the defense attorney could do what we call disrobe this particular witness, and that is to reveal to the jury who they think she is. And I've done that in my capacity as counsel. The goal is to make the jury think that she is their greatest connection to Trayvon Martin's character. So they could literally disrobe her from wearing a fancy suit to where people at the end will conclude that she's wearing a hair scarf with Vaseline on her face, with shrimp earrings, with a hoodie, with sweatpants and Timberland boots. And then that jury could surmise that that apple didn't fall too far from the tree, and what they now see in her is possibly who Trayvon Martin is or is not. So it's very careful how they use this particular witness for their examination. You will notice that we didn't mention Trayvon's mother or father. In our mock trial, we have purposefully chosen not to call them. And I personally and professionally believe that it would be to the state's advantage, as well as the defense, not to call either one of them. You see, according to the records, Trayvon Martin's father did not contact the authorities until the following business day after his son was already deceased. And keep in mind, his son's body was less than 30 feet from his back patio door. And that's important to note because that could suggest to a jury the relationship or lack thereof that Trayvon had with his father. Or more importantly, that which could hurt the case for Trayvon Martin is that a jury would surmise that your father didn't go into the home even looking for you. Why would a father return home from a dinner and not look for a child who's 17 years of age who's visiting? And you have a 7-year-old who was supposedly or otherwise left unattended. So if I'm on the defense side, I would use that to my advantage, that this was an individual who would otherwise stay out late at night, whose time was unaccounted for, whose father really had very little of any control over him. And so for that reason, we figured it would not be to the advantage of the prosecutors to call him as a witness, but obviously the defense has the legal right to call him as what we call an adverse witness. Equally so, we chose to only call witnesses for the purposes of the mock trial that we believe were relevant to that 7-minute period that started immediately when Mr. Zimmerman called 911. And again, those people included, but were not limited to, the two 911 calls that were placed, the Officer Smith, which we will have that role played, along with the medical coroner's report and the girlfriend's role. We're not going to call his mother. She was not there at the time that this young man had been gunned down. She would not otherwise have any information that we believe would be relevant to that which took place. We will be calling the store attendant because the store attendant is ideally the only individual who would be able to attest to Mr. Trayvon Martin's demeanor, character, if you will, and I use that term very, very loosely based on the limited questions or scope of questioning that he could be asked, whether he smelled like marijuana, whether there was admittance of alcohol, did he appear threatening and or belligerent in the time that he encountered him during the store. He was the last person other than Mr. Zimmerman to actually see Mr. Trayvon Martin alive. So his testimony would be very, very, very interesting, to say the least, as to what it is he could say took place concerning him. So with that being said, that is basically the foundation and the questioning and the exhibits that we hope to use in part during the course of the mock trial. What is unique about this mock trial, unlike any other, is that most mock trials are only completed and or started, if you will, upon the completion of an actual case. We purposefully started this before the trial so that our students would have the opportunity to only utilize the evidence that they secured and the preparation that they have set forth. And based on that, they would not be able to pull anything from the actual case. The jury that we've impaneled is a jury of 12. We're going to allow that jury to make a ruling and to submit a verdict. We believe, we really believe, and we're confident that the verdict that we get in this particular mock trial would be the verdict that is reflective of the actual case. And with that, we can allow the prosecutors to proceed with closing.
Oh, this is so fascinating. Dr. Sherry Jefferson, Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, and your students, I'm just at the edge of my seat here. Let's go back to the prosecution, and I apologize. Who was the prosecution? What was the name?
Kimberly Matthews.
Kimberly, there we are. My apologies. Kimberly Matthews, you are ready for your closing, I take it?
Yes, and that's going to be done by Deanna Robinson.
Okay, let's go to Deanna. And Deanna, are you there, my dear? Deanna?
Yes.
Hi, are you ready for your closing?
No, not really. I'm not prepared for it because I'm not around.
Okay, Kimberly, do you want to take...
Is Shanika still
on? No, she seems to have dropped, I believe. Let me just make sure here. No, she has dropped as well. Kimberly, would you like to make the closing?
Yes.
Okay, Kimberly, go ahead. We'll put Deanna Robinson back on hold here. And Kimberly Matthews, closing arguments for the prosecution in our mock trial of George Zimmerman. You have the floor.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kimberly Matthews, and I will be representing... Trayvon Martin. I want to tell you a story about a 17-year-old suspect who was visiting in Sanford, Florida with his dad during the time he was here. He had a thirst for fun, entertainment, quality time with his dad, but all that ended in lieu of him in a confrontation with George Zimmerman. That's all.
Okay, thank you. And let's go to Dr. Sherry Jeffries. Excuse me. Oh, hold on one second here, a little technical issue. Dr. Sherry Jefferson of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. And now are you going to offer us up some more closing? Or?
Yes, I will, and then we can proceed with the defense.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, when we came before you, several days ago, in an effort to explain what we believe the evidence will show, we believe that throughout the course of the last few days that we've presented the following evidence, that we believe that we've presented evidence to substantiate and prove that George Zimmerman unlawfully killed Mr. Trayvon Martin with one gunshot wound to the torso, that it was premeditated, that at all times that he engaged in a physical altercation with Mr. Trayvon Martin, the following transpired. As you listened to the 911 call during the course of this trial, you heard the following things that should resonate in your mind as you deliberate. You heard as follows. You heard the 911 operator instruct Mr. Zimmerman to cease and desist and to not follow Mr. Trayvon Martin. But you also heard no response from Mr. Zimmerman in regard to either acknowledging and or submitting to the directive that had been made. Unique is also the fact that in that same 911 call, you specifically hear the 911 operator ask Mr. George Zimmerman to state his location. In the course of asking him to state his location, you hear Mr. George Zimmerman state that he did not know the building number. We, ladies and gentlemen, believe that that proves that Mr. Zimmerman did not act honestly in his communications with 911, because the evidence presented clearly stated two critical issues. One, that the property that Mr. Trayvon Martin allegedly was standing in front of was that of Mr. Zimmerman's friend. Second, that Mr. Zimmerman at all times alleged that he had served for 3 years as the Neighborhood Watch Association member. Therefore, he should have reason to know either the street address by name and or the number of the location where he was. We believe, ladies and gentlemen, that that evidence proved that Mr. Zimmerman was purposefully attempting to evade the authorities by sending them in a roundabout way so that he could make direct contact with Trayvon Martin before the police would have the opportunity to intervene. In fact, the evidence will show that he sent them around about way to enter into that community. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the evidence that you've heard and their evidence demonstrative and exhibit that you saw. Also, the evidence that you heard and or had the opportunity to review over the course of the last few days that is as much critical as anything else is the fact that when asked where he was going to be, he specifically said for them to call him as opposed to giving them his location. Again, all of these set the stage to establish the element of meditation, premeditation, that this was a premeditated event that took place. So in order for us to prove second-degree murder and manslaughter, we must prove that the act was unlawful, which we believe that it was, that he had a very depraved and disregard for the life of Trayvon Martin. That is further noted by that very same 911 call where he refers to this total stranger strictly because he's standing in the rain as an asshole. The evidence shows that he was already operating in a depraved manner concerning him, one that required him to pursue Mr. Martin with firearm in hand with the sole intent of utilizing that gun to end for Trayvon Martin, not because Mr. Martin engaged in any physical altercation with him, but because, once again, as clearly stated in the 911 call, he did not, quote-unquote, want those assholes to get away. It was very important for him to realize that having called 911 on numerous occasions, that 911 call proves that he was angry and disappointed with the services that the police department had provided in the future, and he wanted to make sure that no one else would ever get away. And he saw to that by bringing out his firearm and using it to fire one gunshot wound into the torso area of Mr. Martin. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we believe that the evidence that you heard today established an unlawful killing, premeditation, and an act that ultimately led to the death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The police report, ladies and gentlemen, clearly establishes for you the mental state of Mr. Zimmerman at the time that he killed Mr. Martin. He uses the term suspect, but there is not one criminal act that he could ever attest that Mr. Martin committed that allowed them to use the term suspect. Suspicious activity in and of itself does not constitute an individual being a suspect for purposes of committing a crime. Sure, he served as a neighborhood watch, but as the evidence showed based on the exhibits and the demonstrative evidence, that community had dozens of apartment homes and that no one person would be able to know every individual who was either a guest and or a resident of that community. Mr. Zivin acted carelessly, recklessly, and had a total disregard for the life of Trayvon Martin. He treated him just like a suspect, and he sentenced him to death. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we ask for you to do unto Mr. Zimmerman what was not able to happen for Mr. Martin, for you to give him his day in court, for you to deliberate based on the facts and the evidence presented, and to deliver a verdict of guilty. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sherry Jefferson from the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, giving the closing arguments for the prosecution. And Dr. Jefferson, what is next?
We are now going to proceed with Christian Stevens and Ebony Harris and Camilla Yancey and allow them to go forward with the defense closing.
Okay, and is Christian Stevens first then?
Ms. Stevens, are you going to deliver first, or Ms. Harris or Ms. Yancey?
Ms. Harris is going to do the closing.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you. This is Ebony Harris from the Investigative Cold Case Research Institute giving us her closing arguments for the defense. Ms. Harris, the floor is yours.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Good evening, everyone. Judge, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, excuse me, my name is Ebony Harris. I am the closing counsel. The prosecutor has failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the offense of second-degree murder and manslaughter of Mr. Martin. George Zimmerman did not commit an unlawful killing because under the Stand Your Ground law, George used self-defense. As was proven today, George was viciously attacked by Mr. Martin, shown by his broken nose and wounds on the back of his head. The Sanford police did not arrest George because his actions were justified by self-defense. Until pressured by the media, 45 days after the incident on February 26, 2012, authorities arrested George. This incident was not premeditated because George called 911 and waited after the call before following Mr. Martin any further. George did not follow Mr. Martin George did follow Mr. Martin to keep a watchful eye until authorities arrived. But unfortunately, authorities did not arrive in the time before an altercation ensued. George and Mr. Martin now have entered mutual combat. During combat, Mr. Martin had got on top of George. While on top of George, he began to slam his head. Now imagine having your head viciously slammed multiple times on the cement, yelling for help, for someone to help you, hoping for someone to help you, but with no idea of knowing when someone would be there. He began to realize he could lose his life and did the only thing he could stop the vicious attack. He shot his gun, one shot, and only one shot. Not knowing he had even hit Mr. Martin, he gets up, and at the time, Witness 11 comes out of his home. He asks Witness 11 to restrain Mr. Martin. Why would he tell this man to restrain him if he knew he had shot him? Everything George has said has coincided with the witnesses and evidence that has been presented. It is our constitutional right to carry a firearm and our legal right to stand our ground in the face of life-threatening positions. Are we going to imprison a man for standing his ground? If so, when and where can we ever defend ourselves, our children, our friends, or even strangers from aggressors and not be punished or sentenced in prison for our actions? And that's it. Thank you.
That was very good. Ebony Harris from the Investigative Cold Case Research Institute. And Dr. Jefferson, who do we have up next?
They have completed the closing, and so now at this point in time, we can go one or two routes. First, I want to thank the students for doing a wonderful job, and obviously thank Professor McCullums, Cheryl McCullums of the Cold Case Institute in Barter College, for all of the support and information and relevant things that she's done to assist these students as well as myself in bringing us to this point where we are today. So I want to openly say thank you to her again. We can open for Q&A if you want to hear from the listening audience, or we can just proceed with some general notes on the significance and the importance of this particular case as it pertains to us, not merely with the Cold Case Institute, but just as citizens in this country.
We do have some questions. We've been taking them while you've been talking, and so I will present them to you, and hopefully you and your students will join right in here and help us understand this case, because there is a lot to understand. Did any of the students have their preconceived ideas changed after going over the evidence they found while you were working on the discovery? Did somebody think that George was guilty and now they think he's innocent, and vice versa? Did you see that happening?
That's a good question.
Cheryl and Dr. Jefferson,
no,
who would
no,
like
Dr.
to go first?
Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson can go. I was just saying that's a really good question.
That is a good question.
Yeah,
it's great.
I agree. I think it's a very good question, and I would like the students to answer that. Any one of them can jump in and state what your original position was and or based on the information you've gathered, where are you now?
I'll tell you what, I am opening the mic so everybody can talk. And let's see, who would like to go?
I would actually like
Who's this?
This is Kimberly. Kimberly. Okay,
Kimberly,
okay.
Go ahead.
Originally, I was for the defense, defending Zimmerman, because he had only did one single gunshot. But looking at the evidence and gathering everything together and what I've observed and went through as being a prosecutor, I feel like he's guilty now. At first, when I thought that he was innocent.
So it really did change your mind going through everything. And that That's interesting that you thought he was innocent in the beginning, and now looking at the evidence, you feel he is guilty. What one thing, is there one thing that made you change your mind, Kimberly?
It was a multiple things. The fact that he didn't call the police after he shot Trayvon, and also to see his shoe off in the picture when they had when they covered up his body, when they did the crime scene pictures and collecting evidence. His shoe was off. So to me, it was inclination that he was running. So that was mine.
Interesting. And then we had somebody else jumping in. Was it, who was it? Was it Christian?
It was Ebony Harris.
Ebony Harris, please take the floor. The floor is yours.
Well, initially when we started everything, I had already had my mindset on George being guilty, and I was so passionate about it, but I didn't know all of the facts in the beginning. But even with the facts, though I'm on defense, I still have my own feelings and take on the whole situation. I do still feel like he's guilty. I do believe that when the case, when everything comes about and it's even more presented on the trial, that he is guilty. I have to say it. I'm sorry, but I want to put my honest opinion out there. And my professors, you know, they've been a very big help in this whole situation for us, opening up our eyes and our minds to it all. So I'm very thankful and grateful for this opportunity. So thank you all.
Well, thank you, Ebony. That's interesting. How difficult has it been for you to be on the defense team with your personal feelings, what they are?
Oh, it was very hard in the beginning. It was hard for me to look at the information and separate it and not put my feelings in it, but just look strictly on facts only. So that's why, and I'm glad that they actually gave us a chance to switch teams, because I wanted to do prosecution. So when I signed up and Ms. McCullum, she said, no, I want you to do defense. And I'm like, I don't really want to do defense. But it opened up my mind, and I was grateful. I'm glad. I'm very happy with the decision. So.
Oh, that's good. Is there anybody else that would like to jump in? Any of the students that would like to answer that question?
I would like to. Ms. Camellia Yancey.
Okay, Camellia, go ahead.
At first, I signed up for the prosecution. I did feel as though that George was guilty, but as we went on with the defense, I've noticed that Trayvon had an opportunity to go straight home. And when he ran from George, he had a chance to go home again. He chose to sit there and wait on George. So I feel as though that there's a possibility George is innocent in this case.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Please continue.
Just the simple fact that he shouldn't have confronted him. He should have just went home when he ran the first time. When he ran away from, when George seen him run, he should have ran home instead of just waiting around to confront him and ask him why.
Right. I was just going to say, you bring up one of the biggest points, I think, that a lot of people feel is going to be imperative in this case, and that is, why didn't Trayvon go home? And that's interesting.
Exactly.
That you caught it, and that's going to be, I think, a big chunk of the defense team. They're going to, you know, I don't know how they'll bring it up, but they'll keep bringing it up. So you have really zeroed in on one of the biggest pieces of evidence that will help George. I don't know if it'll find him not guilty or not, if it's enough of a piece of evidence, but it is a big piece of the question of why all of this happened. Thank you, Camellia. You are fantastic. That was a great answer. Is there anybody else from the Institute that would like to answer the question? Who's talking first?
Deanna Robinson.
Okay, Deanna, go ahead.
My kind of views kind of change on George Zimmerman. I think, like Camilla said, Trayvon Martin had all the opportunity to go home, and he chose not to. He just waited around for the whole time to, you know, And I don't want to repeat everything, but it's kind of true. He could have went home because, one, he had a seven-year-old brother at home. So you could have went straight home to him instead of, you know, waiting around and, you know, endangering yourself. So I believe that so many opportunities, he just didn't want to. He was waiting around for George to retaliate, and the results were death.
And again, Deanna, you bring up, like I said, Camille did, was the fact that this is the biggest, one of the biggest pieces of the defense puzzle as to why this happened. And I think it's going to weigh heavy on the jury's minds, absolutely, when they go into that room to deliberate. That's going to be one of the questions, is why did he stay? Does that mean he attacked George Zimmerman? Was he waiting to attack him when he should have gone home? I don't have the answers. I don't know. But, Deanna, thank you. That is a very good point. Anybody else from the Institute care to take on the question?
Allow me to just...
Sure.
If I
can
just interject very quickly.
Sure. This is Sherry, yes, Dr. Sherry Jefferson.
Yes, if I just may interject very quickly, allow me just from a prosecutorial's perspective to sort of weigh in on their take. Keep in mind, as the students have just said, that Trayvon Martin had a seven-year-old at home to whom he went to purchase the iced tea and the Skittles. And so if you were being followed by a individual who is a stranger, they may very well be that he did not go directly home because he feared that he would be bringing trouble to his front door. Let's remember, Trayvon is not from that area. He was visiting. There was a seven-year-old who was home alone. The father and the mother had gone out for an evening. So maybe, just maybe, and we can all speculate that the reason why he didn't immediately go home was because he feared that by going home, having been followed by Mr. Zimmerman, that he may very well bring trouble into his home. So the flip side of that could be that he was willing to allow his life to be put on the line to save or spare his brother.
There you go. Now I've just changed my mind again, Dr. Jefferson. In 30 seconds, I've totally flip-flopped. You're absolutely right. That is just amazing.
Hey, Trisha, can I jump in, too?
Yes, it's Cheryl McCollum. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I think you can obviously see why everybody is crazy about Dr. Jefferson.
Oh,
this is
yeah.
How she teaches. I mean, she is just, you don't know which way to go. She makes you go left, and then she convinces you that you should have gone right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been the most amazing experience for our students. And I think especially on Father's Day, it's kind of a cool thing that everybody's kind of honoring their father in a special way. And I think for the students to be able to, you know, put their academic challenges, you know, for everybody to see is pretty remarkable. And I hope all of their parents are proud of them for what they're doing. But I want to point out to your audience again, this is all volunteer. This is not a class that they're taking. This is above and beyond their schoolwork and their jobs and their families and their children. This is on top of everything else they've got going on, that they would come into that room and, you know, research with each other and debate with each other and talk with each other. And this is not an easy case. And they have done it with such civility and kindness and intellect that I just have to brag on them for a minute. And you've seen a little bit, you know, of that tonight. But, I mean, they
absolutely
have just done a remarkable job to me.
They really have. And you bring up the word civility. I wish that, you know, some of the people I've seen discussing the case could take a few lessons from the students at the Institute, because
amen,
they are civil and gracious and mature, which, as we've seen a lot of people in this case, when they're trying to discuss it, within moments it just you know, disintegrates into name-calling. So, yeah, they should be commended.
Absolutely.
They're doing an amazing job, and I use that word a lot, but it's absolutely true here. This is an incredible group of people putting together this case. Now, if I may ask a question about the mock jury, who is involved in being on the jury? Is that the rest of the class, or what's the deal?
We opened the door to engage a jury very similar to how you would do it in an actual court setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on that, the students
prosecutor defense teams will engage in voir dire, and they will actually question these individuals. They will then select. We have individuals right now who come as far as Ohio. We have diverse jury pool right now in terms of race and gender and profession. Some who have PhDs, some who have been in law enforcement for several years, some as young as age of 21 years of age, working, not working students. So we tried to pull a jury pool together that has not had any direct contact, if you will, with any of the participants so that their decisions are not swayed. And we're trying to really maintain the integrity of the entire judicial process and teach the students to do the same.
Well, it is certainly apparent in their presentation tonight. We do have a few more questions, if I may. Let me get to our questions here. Let's see. Let me get to them. I apologize. Not having a producer is making me just a little crazy tonight. Okay. Here we go. Oh, well, you just asked it, how they choose the mock jury. That was one of them. Let's talk a little bit about the evidence, if I might. I am very interested in hearing more about the fact that there was no DNA found on the hand. Is that correct? New information. Tell us a little bit more about that, how that works into it and why it's so important.
It's critical because one of the first opportunities that Mr. George Zimmerman had to convey to the police what transpired on that evening was in his police interrogation, which Professor McCollum's provided to her. She has been an excellent resource in her 30 years of investigative experience of bringing to us every bit of information that we needed. And so upon careful review and examination of that actual footage, we learned that he alleged that Mr. Trayvon Martin had placed his hand over his mouth. Now, aside from the issue that currently is pending in the actual case, which is actually who was actually screaming for help, one would speculate or surmise that if a person's hand is covering your mouth and banging your head at the same time, you're in no position to be heard to be screaming. So aside from that issue right there, when Trayvon Martin apparently has the opportunity to remove his hand and he's subject to a gunshot, you would think that at that time that there was in some form of evidence. But upon reviewing the actual medical coroner's report, if I stand to be corrected, it would be on page 3, paragraph 4, which says any other evidence. It specifically notes that he has just a scrape or scratch on the finger, an index finger, if I stand to be corrected. And aside from that, there's no other blood, no plasmas, no findings. And so that, from my perspective, if I were serving as the prosecutor, I would hone in to present to that to the jury in opening. So that by the time the coroner came to take the stand, I would be able to ask the medical coroner to elaborate further as to her finding or his finding, if you will. And so I think that is important because if your hand was being covered with a person who had a bloody nose, there would be some DNA or some form of blood plasma that could be noted on that person's person or body. There is no blood of a third person on the sweatshirt. You know, there's no documentation to substantiate that George Zimmerman's blood is anywhere else other than on his own person. And so, again, I think that would be a point that the prosecutor can hone in on to either, if Mr. Zimmerman were to testify, to impeach him, to cause mm-hmm. him to be caught in a lie, if you will, which is what we refer to as impeachment, or to question the credibility of his statement or the accuracy of some of the things that he's alleged to have taken place. So for that reason, I would think that that would be a critical piece of evidence because if you can prove that Mr. Zimmerman has lied even one scintilla, it would open the door to question the entire incident that took place. And that would include but would not be limited to going back to the issue of why Mr. Martin didn't go home. Could it be that Mr. Trayvon Martin immediately was approached with the firearm? Keep in mind, George Zimmerman had tried out to be a member of the police department. Okay? The police report also assists us in substantiating his connection with the police. He uses terms like exit the vehicle, suspect, a lot of police lingo. With that being said, that brief training, how brief it may have been, he could have pulled that firearm out as soon as he got to the back of the building while Trayvon was running. He could have very easily said halt, and Trayvon would have stopped running. We know that there was a reason why Trayvon stopped. Did he stop because Mr. Zimmerman told him to halt and positioned himself with the 9mm toward Mr. Martin, or did he stop running because the girlfriend asked him why he was running?
okay? If you're a young man and you're running and you've got your girlfriend on the phone, that's why I said she may be a critical witness. She could have said to him, I know you're not running from him. Why are you running? Mm-hmm. Are you afraid? So in his position to try and feel like he's a young man and that he's not afraid, he may have elected to stop running. But there's some reason why he stopped running. And so I'm a defense attorney, but a prosecutor thought would say to me, what caused him to stop running? Was it because Mr. Zimmerman immediately pulled out the firearm and Mr. Martin saw it? Or was it because someone told him to stop running, like the girlfriend, and told him to approach? So that would be something that would be interesting in coming out during the course of this actual trial and even in the mock trial. Because with all due respect, the girlfriend's story may not be as accurate as she's conveyed. Maybe she's the reason why he stopped running. Maybe she's the reason why he may have turned back to approach Mr. Zimmerman. We will never know.
Has it been proven, Dr. Jefferson, that the girlfriend lied about some things? And I don't know if it's going to, if they can even bring it up in court, but didn't her story change quite a bit at some point, or am I mistaken?
To my best knowledge and belief, I'm not going to say that you're mistaken. To my best knowledge and belief, the only issue the prosecutors had with her was, one, she did not know the spelling of Trayvon Martin's first name. Two, she misrepresented her age. She turned out to be a year or two older. Now, will that go to her credibility? Yes, definitely. Will it go to whether or not the significance of why he was shot or why he was not shot? I don't think it would be relevant in that sense. But I think in terms of anything that she says transpired during the course of her telephone conversation, I think from that premise and that premise alone, the defense could use it to either try to impeach her or to have the jury look at her sideways, as we would say, with regard to her credibility or lack thereof. But as it goes to why Trayvon Martin was or was not shot, I don't believe her age, the spelling of the name, or any of those other variables would be that significant.
Okay, Dr. Jefferson, we do actually have a caller on the line with a question. Would you like to take that? Would that be okay with you?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Fantastic. Okay. Caller, area code 952, you're on the air.
Dr. Jefferson, hi. This is Michael in Minnesota. Thank you so much for your thought-provoking whatever testimony.
Thank you.
Yes. I have a quick question. Do we know if the medical examiner swabbed Trayvon's hands for DNA? Because I'm thinking, like you said, you're absolutely right. Saliva should even have been on his hand from George Zimmerman's mouth. But if he didn't test for it, if it was just a visual for blood, maybe that's the answer to that query.
That's an excellent question, and thank you for joining us on this evening for this program. The question would be that the medical examiner, the coroner, is required to, particularly where they ruled, as in this case, that Trayvon Martin's death was by homicide. And so in as much as this particular medical examiner reviewed underneath the nails, the hand for scarring, et cetera, I could reasonably presume that, and rightfully so, that medical examiner also checked for blood residue, gunshot residue, saliva, DNA, and or any other elements that would assist them in understanding how Mr. Martin was subject to homicide. And let me say this, when the medical coroner rules that a death is by homicide, they are in no way implicating George Zimmerman. They're just merely stating that Mr. Trayvon Martin's death was at the hands of someone else.
Interesting.
Can I just add one thing?
Yes, Cheryl McCollum, right ahead.
The autopsy report states very clearly that there was nothing found under Trayvon's nails, so they did scrape. I believe they did test for gunshot residue, but remember, he was in the rain for a little bit, and I don't think that's going to be relevant anyway because there's no question of who shot him. I mean, that's been confirmed by the shooter, but it's just where is the blood? Because, if you have busted somebody's nose and busted somebody's head, Mr. Zimmerman's blood should have been on Trayvon, not just his hands. But I would think if Trayvon reached for that weapon, then there should be a smear on the outside of the jacket. So, I commend the students, for what they're piecing together here and the picture that they're drawing for people. But, again, I think your audience can hear what Dr. Jefferson brings, and it's just that passion. And, y'all, she can tell a story because we've been doing this for weeks now. I've heard her do more than one opening. I've heard her do more than one closing, and I'm captivated every time.
It is
so
amazing.
So, again, I appreciate her talent.
No kidding. I'm just amazed by what I've heard from her. And
Michael,
from her students.
Michael in Minnesota, do you have any other follow-up questions, or does that answer everything for you, my dear?
I think that answers it. How do they have any idea then how George Zimmerman's nose did get broke and how the blood on the back of his head got there if Trayvon didn't do it? Are they going so far as to assume these were somehow self-inflicted?
Oh, my goodness, what an excellent term, because that was something that we did suggest. We thought there could be. But here's another scenario. If I tell you to halt and I'm positioning myself with a firearm, most children aren't going to run away from the gun. You'll run to it. So imagine if I'm Trayvon Martin and I'm trying to attack you because you positioned yourself with the gun in front of me. And when I do that, you shoot me, and I fall on top of you and you fall backwards. You bust your head when you fall backwards. My body lands on your face, and that's how your nose sustains bleeding.
There you go. Wow. Again, I flip-flopped. I keep flip-flopping.
We even had a student, John. John says, you know what? Mr. Zimmerman states very clearly in his video with police that Trayvon raised his hand and says, okay, you got me. Well, John's theory is, that's because Mr. Zimmerman interjected that weapon, and he said, okay, you got me, and then he was shot. So he's sort of telling the truth, and he's sort of not telling the truth. So what they're doing beautifully is reasonable doubt throughout his story, and it's awesome. I mean, they have nailed it to me every time.
Yeah, exactly. Michael, you were going to say something?
Oh, I don't know. Like you, I keep flip-flopping all over the place. I don't know I think anymore.
I feel like a fish out of water, just flip-flop, flip-flop, back and forth, back and forth. I'm so glad I'm not on that jury. I can't imagine. Michael, thank you so much. Do you have any other questions?
No, I don't, but thank you to all the participants. This is a great show, Trish, so thank you very much.
Thank you. And, Michael, thank you for calling in. I do appreciate it. Take care now.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Cheryl McCollum and Dr. Sherry Jefferson, I think we might have some other students who have called in. Let me just take this call really quickly and see. Can you hold on a moment, please?
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, area code 770570. Are you with the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute? Hello? Maybe it's the Phantom. Okay, that was the Phantom student calling in, just letting us know that they're listening. Sorry about that. Without a producer, see, Kim usually does all this work for me. And then if anything goes wrong, I can blame her. But she's not here tonight, so I have to blame myself, which is really annoying.
You're doing a wonderful job.
Oh, thank you. Let me just check and make sure. Oh, yes. This comes from the chat room. Does Trayvon's DNA, is it on the gun? Have they determined that Trayvon's DNA is on the gun yet?
I know there's no fingerprint. That's been confirmed. The other has not been confirmed to my knowledge.
Okay. So that's just one of the things we don't know yet. So, interesting.
Well, I know that there was no blowback on George, and they theorized that the reason there wasn't any blood on the front of his jacket is because the way that the hoodie kind of fell off of him, so you had, 4 or 5 inches away from his body, that it caught it. So that's what they theorized. So that's just from the initial gunshot. But again, the alleged attack would change that dynamic a little bit.
I think we might have another student here, and this might be the Phantom one again, but let me just double check. Area code 404-916. Who am I talking with?
Oh, this is Kimberly. I got disconnected.
Oh, Kimberly, I'm so glad you called back. Okay, we got Kimberly back on the phone. Sorry, I don't know. Sometimes we do have phantoms in here that just disconnect the phones, and I don't know why that happens. Dr. Jefferson, where do we go from here on this portion of the program? What do we do now?
I just want, if I may, to be able to utilize the closing moments to sort of just appeal to the viewing audience now and all those who would have access to this show. And I say this with the utmost respect, and I want to be careful how I say this. There is no doubt that the death of Trayvon Martin is a tragedy. It is a tragedy on any level to lose a loved one. Today is my first Father's Day without my father. We lost my father in October and my brother in August. Prior to that, we hadn't dealt with death for 27 years. So I get it. I understand it from that perspective. Death is painful. What we don't want to do in the course of the next couple of weeks is allow the death of Trayvon Martin to result in such divisiveness where we develop spirits and personalities and actions of hate and bitterness and confusion. I appeal even to the members of the African American community particularly to utilize the death of Trayvon Martin in a way that sends a wake-up call to issues of gun legislation and control, to issues of violence that transpire on a day-to-day basis, that with all due respect, you don't want to allow the death of one individual at the hands of a white person to be equivalent more to the dozens of African Americans that are killing each other every single day in cities like Chicago and all over this country, that by focusing on the death of Trayvon Martin, that you lose sight of the day-to-day plight and dilemma that plagues most communities every single day with death by gunfire. I say that in a very respectful and loving way, if I could use that term, because I would really hate to see what happened in the O.J. Simpson case to happen 15 years later in the Trayvon Martin case. As a people, you cannot live in excuses, deny, and justification, and allege or believe that it is easier to deal with the issue of death as long as that person's death or murder is at the hands of someone else. Every single day in America, there are African-American male children in Trayvon Martin's age group that are being murdered at the hands of their own people. And I say with the utmost respect that it is as critical and important now as ever, ever before that gun legislation that is currently before our legislatures, both locally and congressionally, that we speak out, that we address it, that we visit and revisit the issue of the right to bear arms, what it means, that we use this as an opportunity to engage in background checks, both mental and otherwise, before issuing a license. You cannot drive a car in this country unless you get a license. You cannot get the license unless you take a class. Those are very basic elements. How is it that I could purchase a firearm in the absence of attaining proper training? And so with that being said, proper training and background checks will not preclude and or infringe upon my constitutional right to bear arms. It just makes America a safer place. And so having said that, I really truly hope that the purpose of what we're doing with these students and on your radio show and every other aspect that we're attempting to reach out, that in somehow, some way, that it touches people in such a way where they look beyond race, look at the constitutional and fundamental implications that this case would have, come away from the issue of race, whether it's a black person or a white person, and look at what it's doing for us as a human race. What will a not guilty verdict do for us as a human race? What will a guilty verdict do for us as a human race? Having been a victim of crime myself, I personally need to know that I don't ever have to second guess whether I can use deadly force in a situation to protect my life, my well-being, my safety, because I have to be fearful of whether or not I would be subject to arrest. And I think when we began to look at this case from that perspective, and the flip side of it is, I would never want someone to be able to drive into my community and feel that I've wronged them in any shape, form, or fashion and act in an act of vigilantism and feel like they can be the judge and the jury and sentence me to death without giving me an opportunity to present my case before a jury of my peers. So there are so many other ways that we can look for this rather than operating in excuses, denial, and justification and taking the easy way out. And I hope if Professor McCollums and I did nothing else with the course of the students that we've been working with, that like a tree, they would be planted and rooted where they are, bringing promise, protection, and provision to anyone who comes underneath. And what that basically means is they now have the tools that they need to go back into their communities and say, look at this from another perspective. Let us not react like the Rodney King incident. Let us not react like they did during the O.J. Simpson case. Let us look at this from a way that will help all of us.
Amen, Dr. Jefferson. And I have to tell you, Cheryl McCollum was right. You are truly an inspiration to everybody listening and who will be listening in the weeks to come. This show will be available pretty much forever for everybody to listen to. Dr. Jefferson and Cheryl McCollum, thank you so much. Cheryl, tell us how people can find out more information about the Institute.
Well, they can go to the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute.org, or they can find us on Facebook a couple of different ways. There's my Facebook page, and then there's the director of the Cold Case Institute page. And Dr. Jefferson also has a website, Family Law Center. Is that .org?
Yes, .org.
And again, you know, I tried to pitch this show to y'all in the right way, but I tell you, it exceeded what I even hoped they would be able to do. And again, Tricia, thank you. And I think by allowing everybody to hear this show, people are going to be able to hear what Dr. Jefferson just said, and they'll be able to accept it, I think, overwhelmingly. And I think the outcome of this trial will be much, much different, even as the broader community. So thank you so much again, Tricia.
It's my pleasure, and I want to definitely thank from the bottom of my heart your wonderful students. It's not easy coming on the radio. That's a hard thing to do. It's hard enough to speak in front of somebody, let alone knowing that you're on the radio doing it. I think everybody did a great job. It's going to sound strange, but I'm very proud of you all. You've all just been truly inspirational, like I said earlier. And thank you, ladies. Thank you so much. And Cheryl, we'll be talking to you again next week. It's getting closer. And we'll see. It's going to be interesting to see. It's going to be interesting to see how it turns out at your school and in the real trial. That is going to be fascinating.
And we will definitely keep y'all updated.
Thank you, Cheryl. Dr. Sherry Jefferson, thank you very much. You take care now.
Thank you so much for having us, and I thank my students for participating, and thank you, Professor McCollum.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Oh, my goodness. That was truly, and I keep using this word, but it's true, it was an amazing show. And you got to give those kids, and maybe they're not kids, maybe they're as old as me, but you got to give them credit to be able to try and put down your thoughts into words and then give it out to a whole listening audience. It is not easy. And add to the fact that they had to go on the side that they didn't even believe in. That, to me, is what made this whole show so very, very interesting. And I want to thank Rang for helping me out in the chat room tonight. It was great. We didn't have any problems, I don't believe. Everybody was really nice in the chat room, which is fantastic. We've had a lot of people ask when we're going to open up the discussion for the George Zimmerman trial on Web Sleuths. We will be opening a thread. At the earliest, it'll be the day of the trial when it actually starts. And hopefully we'll be able to keep it open and just keep it moving. Next week, I have no idea, because who knows what's going to happen in the upcoming week. But whatever it is, if it's true crime, you know, we will be talking about it. And Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by the brand spanking new forum on Web Sleuths. It's the Web Sleuths Weather Forum. If you love the weather, whether or not you love the weather, you got to check out this forum. Go to www.websleuths.com/forums, and at the top of the page, you'll see the link to our new weather forum. Now, do remember this, please. The opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuths.com, LLC, and forumsforjustice.org. In other words, Trisha's True Crime Radio is just it. It's Trisha and me and True Crime and you. We're all together in this as one. So if you get upset, if you get your true crime patties in a wad, then what you do is you come to Trisha's True Crime Radio to complain about it. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. I know I certainly did. And thank you very, very much for joining us. We'll be back next week, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events. And we always, always, always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.